So it's with great pleasure that I'm introducing Cathy McElwain, who is a Professor of Geography at Queen Mary University of London. Her work is rooted in development geography, and her early work, which focused mainly in Latin America, but also in the Philippines and Botswana, focused on development processes in relation to gender, poverty, employment and household livelihoods, with subsequent research on issues of urban violence. More recently, her work's focused on international migration to the UK and on north-south linkages. In particular, she has, for the past 6 years, been conducting research relating to Latin American migration to the UK, and her most recent book, Cross-Border Migration and Latin Americans, European Perspectives and Beyond, is really the first volume that brings together, in a comparative perspective, work on Latin Americans in the UK and Europe. She's currently working on a project called Mapping Philanthropism, Community Engagement in East London, and has just completed a project for UN Habitat and jointly authored their State of Women in Cities report.
Thank you very much, Olivia. It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you very much for the invitation. And what I should also say is that Olivia is one of my former PhD students, and it's very nice that there are several PhD students now working on the issue of Latin American migration within Europe and beyond. So it's very nice to be able to come here and talk about that issue today. What I'd like to say at the beginning is, as Olivia said, I'm actually a development geographer by training. And again, I'd like to be able to say that I strategically worked first in Latin America and then with Latin Americans in London. But actually, it's come about really by work-life balance in terms of having a family and then actually realising that there was a very large community of Latin Americans in London about which we knew very little. So that's sort of the reason why I ended up getting into this type of research, partly because I lived in North London and realised there was a large Colombian community in Seven Sisters. So this was sort of the reason why I then moved in to look at this. So in terms of what I want to talk about today, I'll just say a little bit about the conceptualizations and the framework that I'm using to talk about the Latin Americans. I'm trying to do it from a more European perspective, but focusing on London. And I'll just say a little bit about who Latin Americans are, again, because they're a relatively new migrant group. And then I'll also just go through, again, using the framework, which is looking at transnational social spaces from a sort of a Bourdieu forms of capital type of approach. And then I'll say something at the end on the effects of global economic crisis as well. And I should say that this is also based on a paper that's just been published earlier on this year in the Cambridge Journal of Regions, Economy and Society. I think I've got that right. I think it's based here at Oxford, actually. Although it's not exactly the same, the stuff on global economic crisis is some other stuff that I've been doing more recently. Again, I don't want to go through, I'm sure everybody in this room knows what a transnational social field is. But a lot of the work that I've been doing, or that I was doing before I could, you know, started writing this paper, was obviously based and very much based on sort of transnationality. When I started to look at the empirical data from my research, I kept thinking, well, you know, transnationality is supposed to be about flexibility, it's supposed to be about multiple connections. And then when you actually read the empirical work on transnational linkages, it does tend to be very much about from one country, source destinations, and it's not really transnational as such. What I was finding, which is really what I want to talk about today, is much more complex sets of linkages in various different ways. So basically, really, a lot of the empirical work, and I've said here, you know, it's about bifocality or a dual frame of reference, and it's not plurilocal. And so what I really wanted to do was to sort of challenge this idea about, you know, it's much more than just source destination linkages. There are some exceptions to that, and that relates to transnational elites and what are called twice migrants, where people will sort of like step migration. And then some more recent work on onward migration. But this tends to focus on refugees or irregular migrants, or on one nationality group. Whereas what I wanted to look at, and what I have been looking at, is Latin Americans with multiple nationalities, which I'll talk a bit more about, but also with multiple relationships to different European countries because of immigration regimes as well, which obviously affects their mobility and the ways in which transnational practices and processes actually function. Now, again, I'm sure I don't need to go through Bourdieu with people here, but basically, I sort of took a lot of the work done on capitals, economic, social, and cultural capital, which has been used a lot in terms of the poverty work. Actually, interestingly, some of the older work that I'd done on poverty in the global south, and then it has been used increasingly in relation to migration. And again, a very nice work that I think is really helpful by Phil Kelly and Lucis on transnational habitus, where they looked at Filipinos in Canada, again looking at these ideas of capital, and then Caroline Moser's work on transnational assets, where she looked at Ecuadorians between moving between Guayaquil and Ecuador and Barcelona. Then this also has been complemented by work that this is some of the work that I mentioned that I was doing with other colleagues at Queen Mary. We looked at this idea of practices and migrant practices, but very much in destination, so in London. So the ways in which, in particular, migrants develop different types of tactics in order to deal particularly with exclusion in destination labour markets in particular. But what I really wanted to look at then was the ways in which capitals are accumulated, converted, depleted, and exchanged within these transnational spaces. And although people talk about this a lot and say, yes, you know, we're doing work on this, and yes, we're taking this approach, as I said, to reiterate, when it actually comes to it, that it tends not to be. It tends to be much more between two countries alone. So I've called these, in terms of what I want to look at, and that's what framing what I'm going to be talking about, capital negotiating practices. And again, I'm stressing the complexity in terms of the ways in which, in this case, Latin Americans move over more than one border, amongst more than one nationality group, and also amongst more than one immigration status. And again, we've got a huge complexity because I'm looking at people coming from lots of different contexts. We've got a hugely complex set of immigration regimes that need to be negotiated. In terms of the research, I actually started in 2005 just working with Colombians, but I've based this work that I'm talking about today on two projects. One which was with Colombians, Ecuadorians and Bolivians only, and that was a Leverhulme project, and at the same time as I was doing that, I was working with a migrant organisation in North London called Carila. And then another project which was funded by the Trust for London that work on BME and poverty reduction in London in lots of different ways, and the Latin American Women's Rights Service. And they actually commissioned this research. It was commissioned, and it was commissioned deliberately to be the first study that was a quantitative survey of the Latin American community in London. And so we did over 1,000. We did a survey with over 1,000 Latin Americans. In-depth interviews and focus groups and so on. And I should actually say that Olivia was involved in that project as well with the Brazilian population. We included Brazilians in that. And so Olivia was one of the researchers. I had a whole team, actually, because it was a very big project. I had a team, I think, of 12. I think Olivia was actually the only non-Latin American, about 11 Latin Americans working with me on that. Very briefly, and I said this earlier, Latin Americans are a new migrant group to London, and before that they'd only lived in London as political exiles or linked with trade. Having said that, the Colombians did arrive from the 1970s onwards through the work permit system. Again, very interestingly, by chance, a Colombian started going back. He'd migrated to London, and he'd started going back to Colombia selling work permits in the coffee zone in Colombia. And I actually interviewed a woman who'd arrived in 1977, her and her husband, who'd bought these work permits from a place called Armenia, which is in the centre of the coffee zone in Colombia. And they'd come and worked in restaurants in Piccadilly Circus. And also, at this time, Colombians were arriving and they were working Croydon as well in hospitals. We also had, again, refugees arriving at this time, mainly Chileans, but also some Colombians, Argentinians, Uruguayans. And this is where the first organisations started developing. And they initially started working, looking at justice issues in Latin America and supporting mainly sort of left-wing, again, people who were exiled, supporting various campaigns in Latin America itself. But then they've started to change over time, and now these organisations, which still exist, now work in terms of improving welfare and improving access to services for the Latin American community itself. So although the Colombians were the first nationality group to arrive, this has since diversified to Ecuadorians, Peruvians, Brazilians and Bolivians. And I'll say a bit more about them. Basically, Brazilians and Bolivians are the two most recent group. And as a result, the Brazilians in particular are very diverse. But the Bolivians tend to be the most exploited group, the most likely to be irregular and working in the sort of the lowest status jobs. What we also did, which was I didn't do it myself, it was a bit of a nightmare, but we had to, not surprisingly, all the organisations want to know how many Latin Americans there are in London, and they want to know exact figures, and everybody thinks that they know how to calculate it. And we had a terrible time actually trying to do this, because we did it in 2008-09, so we had to use the old census, and actually what we need to do is update it with the new census data. But we had to find a statistically robust way of coming up with a figure as to how many Latin Americans there were. And this also includes some second generation. We used birth certificates, actually, birth certificate data to find out about the second generation. But basically, the first figure is actually robust. 113,500 in London, and then we extrapolated. This is much less robust, and I won't go into all the complicated. I mean, I won't be able to go into all the complicated things behind it, because I'm a geographer who works in qualitative stuff normally, so I employed an economist to do all the statistical stuff for me. But basically, we had to have different estimates and so on. We found out, again, we knew this anyway, Brazilians are the largest group, followed by Colombians. And then, as I said, with relatively large groups of Ecuadorians, Bolivians and Peruvians. And again, I'll just go over this very quickly. This is just from the survey. The survey was broadly representative. We used lots of different entry points in terms of doing the survey, and it was broadly representative of the different nationality groups. The other thing that we did do is we also did it across the socioeconomic spectrum. So we worked across the socioeconomic spectrum. The first project, I dealt sort of with working class Latin Americans, but I worked with a whole range in this project that I'm mainly talking about here. In terms, this is a bit fuzzy, this map, sorry. In terms of where Latin Americans live, the key thing is actually that they are quite dispersed across London. There are Latin Americans in every single borough in London, which in some ways is quite unusual, because often you get clusters. But obviously we have some clustering. We have clustering particularly in Lambeth and Southwark. We've also got, again, inner London, and we've got some clustering, for example, in Barnet and Brent, where Brazilians tend to be concentrated. But as I said, Southwark and Lambeth are the two main places where there's most Latin Americans living. One thing I should say, actually, just literally, I think about 4 weeks ago, Southwark Council is the first council that's officially recognised Latin Americans as an ethnic group. There's a big campaign, which I don't think I'm actually going to mention here, but I think it's quite significant that one of the London boroughs is now, and they use that in their ethnic categorisation, for accessing services and so on. And a lot of other of these councils, Hackney does it and Haringey do it informally, but Southwark, put out a press release and actually formally say that they are now categorising according to this. So it actually shows you just how important the Latin American community is becoming in London. Again, just very, very briefly, although we worked across the whole socioeconomic spectrum, not surprisingly for migrant groups, there was concentration amongst the economically active. They were very well educated. 70% had education beyond high school, secondary school. But a third were unable to speak more than a little English. We also had very, very high concentrations of people working in elementary jobs, particularly cleaning, especially contract cleaning in big offices. That was the most common job, as well as things like kitchen work, security guards and so on. We looked at class status, which again I know is very complex, and class means different things in different countries, let alone between Latin America and the UK. But again, not surprisingly, because of this occupational issue here, people felt that their class status had declined. Again, we tried to look at ethnicity, but actually the question didn't really mean much in the end. The people, I won't go into it, but the whole ethnic categorisation thing is a whole political issue in itself, and there's been a lot of campaigns going on, and there's been a campaign which hasn't really, well, it was the first campaign to actually raise the issue, but someone, and a Peruvian guy, was trying to get the term Ibero-American to be sort of one of the official sort of designation for Latin Americans, plus obviously Spanish, Portuguese, whatever. And they were really, really interested in us asking this. But actually we asked it, and not surprisingly, it was a complete muddle. Some people said that they were Latin American, some people said they were white, some people said they were mestizo, and, you know, it was what you do expect, I think, in terms of Latin America. What I would say, actually, I gave a talk in the summer in Canning House, and I had my first ever hate email from a member of the Latin American community, from a Brazilian guy, who told me that I was racist because I was arguing that it was a good idea for ethnic categorization of Latin Americans. And then, so he sent me an email beforehand, and then he turned up at Canning House to heckle me in the audience. And he told me that, you know, I obviously didn't understand Latin America and didn't understand Brazil, and there was more than one racial group in Latin America. So it's a very, very heated issue, as you can imagine. And we did try and explain, and actually, thankfully, lots of other people who were Latin American in the room actually stood up for me and said, that's not the point, that's not what we're trying to get out here, but it's a very contentious issue. In terms of my migration trajectories, again, I said this is a new migrant group. The people that we interviewed, two-thirds have arrived since 2000 and one-third since 2005. And again, we carried this work out between 2009 and 2010. So really, a lot of very, very recent migrants. Two-thirds had entered on temporary visas, mainly, I won't go into the details, but mainly tourist visas, or sometimes without visas at all. Again, it depended on what country that they came from. What, again, not surprisingly, what has happened even during since 2005, since I've been working with Latin Americans, is increasingly visa restrictions. Once the Home Office or the UKBA realises that there's too many Ecuadorians coming in or too many Bolivians coming in, then they're imposing visa restrictions, and that's happened over the last few years. More than half, though, have permanent immigration status, particularly Colombians, because they've been here for the longest time, and 19%. Officially stated or openly stated that they didn't have they were irregular and they didn't have legal status or legal papers, which is again relatively high, and it's probably obviously higher than that because of all the sort of the semi-compliant people. So it's probably nearer a quarter or even more than that even actually. Okay, so what I want to look at here then, obviously, I'm talking about this from the perspective of London, but what really struck me is that we did ask in the survey about where people had come from. And what I realised is that actually, although just under two-thirds of people were coming directly from Latin America to London, there was also 36.5% who'd actually lived somewhere else before they came. And in particular, Spain was emerging as a major gateway to Europe. And for lots of different reasons, many of which revolve around, again, immigration regimes, which I've been talking about. Italy and Portugal were also important, especially for Portuguese. And I'll say a bit more about that in a moment. This is also much more recent as well in terms of sort of negotiating Europe in terms of arrival, because almost half of those who'd arrived since 2005 had lived somewhere else. Ecuadorians in particular, again, I'm sure many of you know this already, but a lot of Ecuadorians had moved to Spain first, followed probably by Colombians. And it was Ecuadorians and Bolivians who were the most likely to have lived somewhere else. Some had left, I think about 12% of the sample had lived in the US as well. So it wasn't just European, but it was predominantly Europe that they'd lived in beforehand. The other thing that I found, though, not just from the quantitative data, but from the qualitative research that we did, is that, and again, this comes into the conceptual point that I made earlier, is that a lot of these ties that were maintained with the home country were also ties developed within Europe, and so, you know, and there's an example here of a Brazilian who was working as a cleaner in London, but she'd accessed her Italian passport through Ancestry in Italy, and this is quite common actually, of Italians going in and again for obviously earlier forms of migration from Italy to Brazil, getting official European papers in Italy, but then a lot of them didn't like Italy. They said it was racist, they didn't get decent jobs there, pay was very low, and then go somewhere else, often to Germany, but also to London in this case. So what I found is that then, because of this movement within Europe, you actually did get genuinely transnational ties being maintained across borders. So again, not just between, say, London and Brazil. Okay, so to move on then, just to say something about the different types, again, according to the framework that I set out. Again, I'm sure I don't need to tell this room this, but... you know, it's obviously strikingly obvious when we look at Europe that, you know, we have a highly regulated immigration regime within Europe, sometimes called Fortress Europe. But this obviously affects how people move within the continent. The way in which I've conceptualised this is by talking about, again, from this Bourdieu capital approach, forms of capital approach, is talking about mobilising civic capital in relation to the ways in which people access, negotiate, subvert, claim citizenship rights and immigration status, again, which is highly complex. And basically, what I found and what I'm arguing is that, you know, migration via Spain, Italy, and Portugal, sorry, this little thing again, is a way of negotiating these types of immigration regimes. The reason being, and I'll come back to this in a moment, is that for various historical reasons, particularly in southern Europe, and I'll outline these in a second, it's often easier to get into Spain, Italy and Portugal, certainly now, than into the UK. But that's not the only reason, as I'll show. The other interesting point is when we also, if you look at people's current immigration status, is that, I also differentiated between those, what I call the onward migrants, which are the ones who'd lived elsewhere, and those who'd migrated directly, because 37% of onward migrants had EU passports, compared with only 8% of those who came directly. And again, not surprisingly, so these are people, as I'll show as I go through, who had gone and regularised their status legally and illegally before coming to the UK. Sorry, this is a point here that I was just going to make. Again, most of the migration is via southern Europe. It's partly to do with historical ties, you know, the obvious ones in terms of Brazil and Spain. Language, again, which is really important, although I'll come back to language because, again, it's not as straightforward as saying, well, we migrated to Spain because we could speak Spanish, or we migrated to Portugal because we could speak Portuguese. Then we've got, obviously, the historical patterns, the Catholic Church, and I'll mention a case of the Catholic Church in a moment, but that's been important, not in terms of migration, obviously not in terms of migration to the UK, but in particularly to Spain. We've often also got, crucially, which has obviously completely collapsed now, which is why I wanted to say something about the economic crisis at the end of the paper, is that at the time, huge economic growth rates and large-scale labour demand for basically low-paid labour, particularly in domestic service, elder care, construction and agriculture. When it came to immigration laws as well, a whole series, particularly in Spain, in the case of Italy in particular, we have ancestry claims, which are very important. To a lesser extent, Portugal as well. And then Spain, because of labour demand, had a whole series of regularisation and amnesty programmes, as well as a set of bilateral agreements, particularly with Ecuador, which also facilitated widespread migration from Ecuador to Spain in particular. What I also found, and sorry for all the words, but it was just so that I could put my examples in here, again, what I've called, again, based on previous work actually in Latin America, is the way in which civic capital can also be perverse. And by this, and I mentioned this earlier, is that mobilising the civic capital can be done legally and illegally, basically, is what I'm saying. And so what I found is that people were regularising legally through amnesties and ancestry claims, and this is an example of an Ecuadorian who regularised through an amnesty and then moved on to the UK once she got her European passport. But there was also really very common buying of false passports, anything between $800 and $2,000 or euros ago, and these also these were sometimes borrowed, so sometimes you used it just to enter, and then you had to send the passport back. But again, and they were usually of regularised Latin Americans as well. And again, this is a case of another Ecuadorian who went to Spain, left her son with her grandmother, couldn't find work in Madrid, then got a false Spanish passport, came to London, worked as a cleaner, and then did the same thing for her son as well. So there is a big black market in false passports, as there are for other nationalities, obviously. Smuggling wasn't, it could be that I just didn't come across it, but smuggling didn't come, wasn't as prevalent as actually I thought it might be, even though, there's obviously this market and false papers. But it did exist, and it tended to be actually amongst Colombians rather than Ecuadorians, although there is a case of an Ecuadorian here. This one, which I won't go into, but it was a fascinating case actually of someone who used to be in the FARC guerrilla organisation in Colombia, and he'd been forcibly conscripted. He was a campesino, he was a peasant, and he'd actually escaped. Him and his brother had escaped, and his brother had been shot on escape, but he managed to get away. And he paid a smuggler to get to Madrid, and then got in a lorry via the Netherlands. What actually happened after this? It's the most fascinating interview I think I've ever done. He then got deported. He then tried to claim asylum at the Home Office. The Home Office deported him. So he was deported back to Colombia, and said the FARC was still after him. Obviously, he's incredibly much less powerful now, but at the time, incredibly powerful guerrilla organisation. And so he went from Colombia to Venezuela and bought a tour. A lot of Latin American, well, the middle classes, as I'm sure you know, go on these tours around Europe. Went on a tour in Europe and basically jumped off at London. So he was back in London, and I actually met him through an organisation he was trying to regularise. He was trying to marry his Colombian girlfriend who had papers, and he wanted to be able to, he was trying to regularise. So it's a fascinating story of someone, in a very convoluted and complex migration chain, but via smuggling. Again, another one came via Eurostar. What was also very interesting, actually, in the work that I did, is that some of these people that were smuggled in ended up being British citizens as well. So you get these really complex, negotiations. I don't know what happened to him. Not surprisingly, this was somebody who wouldn't give me his phone number and wouldn't give me his proper name because of, the background. So I've no idea what actually happened to him. The other important thing is that EU passports obviously gives access to the labour market in London as well. And this was a case of someone who'd also mobilised social capital in that her father sent her a false passport from Spain to allow her and her husband to work. Because she'd initially come in she was an overstayer. So she was an Ecuadorian overstayer, become a regular, and was able to work in. Then her husband got a job at the BBC, cleaning the BBC, and she was working at the tills in Tesco. So two bastions of, British society. Not surprisingly, full of Latin Americans. Apparently, when Tony Blair was a prime minister, he had a Colombian cleaner, apparently. So somebody, the only Colombian who's in the Metropolitan Police Service is told me that actually. So they found out through the Met. So economic capital, again, not surprisingly, underpins a lot of this movement that we're talking about. Over 40% of people moved for economic opportunities, although, as we know, migration is much more complicated, but this was the primary reason. The other thing that's important is in terms of this capitals approach, it's not just about accumulating capital, it's also about the depletion of it. And a lot of migrants actually arrived very much depleted economically, in that they borrowed money in order to migrate. Again, quite a common story, but 4 out of 10 arrived in London still owing money. Interestingly, and again perhaps not surprisingly, the onward migrants, so those that had come via another country, were less likely to be indebted. And this was usually because they went and, you know, they'd made money along the way, because they've got a more, because they had a, you say, a more complex migration trajectory. There's also this perception that you, it was, because I kept saying to people, particularly the onward migrants, why didn't you stay in Spain? And he kept saying, oh, you can get better paid jobs. It's all about the Libre Esterlina. And I'm thinking, well, you know, it costs a lot to live in London. It's a really expensive city to live in. They said, well, yes, well, we realised that when we got here. But, you know, we kept thinking that the pound was better than the euro, or it's better than the dollar. And then they arrive and they're really shocked at how expensive everything is. But there's still this perception that you can get better paid jobs in London than you can in Spain. And I'll say more about the recession, because obviously that's really affected the more recent patterns of flow since 2008. Again, there's a lot of people very disillusioned with Spain, particularly those who are working in agriculture and construction, which was the male labour force. And again, this is an example below of, again, somebody being retrenched. He was working in a factory in Spain and actually left his wife and children behind. And I'll come back to that case, actually, in a moment. Very important is remittances, the ways in which economic capital is accumulated and converted through remittances. Not surprisingly, with high levels of remittance sending and a median of £2,000 sent every year. And this constituted, at the lowest level, 12% of personal weekly income, but another 23% of that was also saved. So sometimes people saved up and then sent big lump sums, depending on what they were sending it for. So if they were buying land or if they were building houses, they would save up here and then send a lump sum. Or if they were, you know, sending money for, say, educational expenses or sort of, you know, food, rent or whatever, then they'd send smaller proportions. And this I rather love. This was a postcard that I found in one of the Latin American shops in Elephant and Castle. For those of you that don't speak Spanish, it says, buy your house in Colombia, you know, with a picture of Tower Bridge on it. And basically it was for getting mortgages. They have mortgage fairs in London now for Latin Americans to take out a mortgage with Colombian mortgage companies. There are several of them, and they're quite, I think they're annual events now. Again, I picked this up in one of these shops as well, and the reason I like it is because it actually shows about, it was written in English and in Spanish, and it says, you know, number one in Spain starts operations in London. Again, it highlights the fact that, the fact that Latin Americans are living in both places, but also that we have remittances within Europe. This is the second part, where people are sending money between Spain, particularly where you have households between the two, Spain, Italy, wherever it might be. This is actually a case of someone needing money from a cousin who lived in France. In some cases as well, when people had lost jobs, we found reverse remittances. So Colombians having to send money, usually in case where somebody was temporarily unemployed, having to send money actually from Latin America. And we found this in other work that I've done in London as well with other low-paid migrant workers. The other issue that I looked at, again, from the capitals approach is what's called institutional cultural capital. Mainly sort of human capital, but also I wanted to include language skills. And Bourdieu includes sort of accents and ethnicity and race and so on. But what I found, again, is and I mentioned this earlier, I'd say to people, why did you leave Spain? This is, you know, again, before the recession, when you could speak the language, you could get, it was easier to access jobs. Because, again, one of the issues here, in London, is the fact that, you know, people can't get decent jobs because they can't speak English. So I kept saying, well, why did you leave Spain? But there was this idea, again, amongst these onward migrants, that It was the pure English, so not American English, but English, El Inglés Puro, that they kept calling it, would increase their status. So if they came to London, they'd learn so-called Queen's English. If they went back to Latin America, they'd have a higher status as a result. Basically, a sort of a classic form of Bourdieu's linguistic capital. But of course, then when they arrive, they end up having to work in cleaning because they can't speak English. They clean with other Latin Americans for a Latin American supervisor, and it's incredibly difficult for them to learn. And then when we asked in the survey, what's the main problem? I think the main problem was, you know, lack of language skill, or lack of, you know, being able to speak English as a major barrier. This, again, very briefly, just also shows de-skilling. Because of this lack of linguistic capital, amongst other things, there's obviously discrimination. 70% of the survey, people surveyed, actually said they felt discrimination in some way, and it was primarily in the labour market. But we asked people what they did at home, what they did when they first arrived, and what their current occupation was. And I won't go through all of this, but of course you can see this huge, if we focus on the elementary, hardly anybody works in cleaning type jobs back home in Latin America. When they first arrived, we're up to nearly 70%, and then afterwards, again, this obviously varies according to how long people have been there, it went down to about 40. And then the opposite was the case in terms of professional workers. In terms of social capital then, I've mentioned that in various ways. Obviously very important in terms of settling. Been lots and lots of work done on this from a migration perspective. Again, not surprisingly, 40% said they came to London because they already had contacts here. Although, it also shows that 60% found other reasons, and there were other reasons why they did come, which was also, I think, significant. This is also what I mentioned earlier, is the creation, and there's been lots of really good work specifically on this, on transnational families and the creation of transnational families. But what I found interesting from what I'm looking at here, again, in a truly transnational way, is that these transnational families weren't just between Latin America and London, but they were actually within Europe as well. And this is an example of a Bolivian who'd left a daughter with the father in Bolivia. Then the father left, she was left with her aunts, then she was then sent to Barcelona, then came from Barcelona to the UK. Again, around these false, with false Spanish passports. So we have these families, and these extended families, extending spatially over different borders, which I think is, again, very interesting. The other thing is although the networks are very strong, there are also negative dimensions to them. Colombians in particular talked about negative forms of social capital, and this was partly in relation to the armed conflict and the fact that people still felt that they were sort of there were sort of negative dimensions of sort of informants, people linked with guerrilla groups, paramilitaries, and so on. So that was a sort of a slight issue amongst Colombians. The other issue is trust. Now, people always sort of say, which is an issue amongst Brazilians as well, and certainly Olivia found this in research that she's been doing. If you actually ask people, do you trust other Latin Americans or other, you know, Colombians, Bolivians, or whatever, they'll say, oh, no, not really. We had actually just under half that said that they didn't. But when you talk to them, say, I don't trust them, they wouldn't actually. It actually turns out that they only go to Latin American places, they use Latin American shops, they go to Latin American carnivals, and they don't really have any, you know, not necessarily any British friends. So you've got this very sort of contradictory situation whereby they'll say, and a lot of it's class-based as well. A lot of the lack of trust, when you ask people, it's all about individualism or envidia. If we keep talking about it, it's all about envidia, and it's all about, you know, having papers. And it says an example here of a Colombian, said there's a lot of envy when you meet someone from your own country, and it's about status. And I did come across people's stories, you know, about people saying that they'd been, you know, you'd have a fight, and if you know someone was irregular or, you know, they were illegal, you would denounce them to the UKBA. Whether this actually happened, I don't know. There's just lots of stories about it. But having said this, and this is the point that I made earlier, we've still got a third of people using migrant community organisations, primarily Latin American ones, 70% attending church services. This is St George's Cathedral, which is in Southwark, there's several Latin American masses every Sunday in Latin America. Two-thirds go to the summer carnivals. There's a big carnival every year in Burgess Park in South London. And then 85% use shops and so on. Again, very, very briefly, the important point, and I'll just skip through this, the important point here is that the numbers of people coming via Europe, and particularly from Spain, not surprisingly, has increased since 2008. Last week, I met with the director of the Latin American Women's Rights Service, and she said they're completely inundated with people coming from Spain. And they have a problem. The problem that they've got is that they only serve so-called Latin Americans, and these people are coming with Spanish passports, and then they're having to turn them away. So you've got this really complicated situation where they're, in many ways, they're privileged because they've got passports, but they can't access these types of services. Now, again, I haven't looked into this as a very recent thing. So basically, I'm saying that, you know, intra-European migration increases. So these transnational social spaces are actually becoming even more complex as a result of recession. Irregularity is increasing, not surprisingly, and overstaying is increasing. I'll just go through this really quickly. Households are also becoming more transnational, and there's again cases of particularly the mortgage crisis in Spain that some of you, I'm sure, will know about. In fact, I heard somebody talking about that this morning because of the big strikes that are going on today. The mortgage crisis in Spain mean that Ecuadorians in particular often can't leave, or they will leave mothers and children behind in Spain while the man has come to London. I came across several cases of that because of this, the fact that they've got all this negative equity on mortgages. And then we've got insecurities in the labour market, increasing exploitation that people have been talking about. Because I explicitly asked people in the in-depth interviews what were the effects of the crisis in terms of your current working conditions. And say, you know, people having to work more for less, basically. Remittances have declined, and people argue about the changes in exchange rates. This I actually rather like as well. This is another that says, make your dream a reality, and it's some place in Newington Green Road in London, with the Banco de Bilbao or something. So it's actually a Spanish bank lending money in London to build your house in Colombia, which I rather like. I think that exemplifies it. Okay, so hopefully I've shown you the ways in which Latin Americans are moving in complex ways to maximise their well-being. They are mobilising assets, as well as depleting them and accumulating them in lots of different ways and in very much interrelated ways. Again, what I argue in terms of these capital negotiating practices is that it's really important to genuinely recognise the transnationality of how people move, and that we need to move away empirically from these sort of source, looking at just source destination linkages, to really understand how transnational social spaces really function. Okay, thank you. I'll leave it there.
Thank you very much.
So I ran over.